Music waste, congratulations. You lasted longer than us because you didn't have to suck on the money tit. And hallelujah to that.
The next station is.
Thank you so much for tuning in to CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the unceded, ancestral, traditional, and shared territories of the Musqueam, the Squamish, and the Tsleil-Waututh Nations in the city colonially known as Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, to hear Time Not Wasted, a radio documentary looking back at 30 years of Music Waste Festival. This is part one. Hallelujah to that. I'm Dora. And you just heard Sneakin' on the Subway by Smack off of their album, The Higher State of Cluelessness. In this episode, we're going to hear from past organizers of Music Waste Festival as we go through its basic history and talk about maybe the more nuanced side of its role in Vancouver's art scene. So we've got quite a bit to get into. 30 years is a long freaking time for a volunteer-run, no-profit DIY music and arts festival to run, especially in Vancouver. I don't know if you've ever been to Music Waste or if you even know what it is, but just to get a feel, let's, for a second, imagine the first or sometimes second weekend of June in Vancouver. East Vancouver, to be more exact. According to the June weather history graciously provided by weatherspark.com, the temperature is most likely hovering around 19 degrees, ranging from cool to comfortable, and there's been some light rain throughout the day. Nothing that would keep you inside, but you might take your umbrella with you when you go out, just in case. Spring is truly holding on by its last little thread before summer, sweet, glorious summer, takes over the city. It's exciting. And there's something in the air. You feel like you need to ask permission for something, but you're not quite sure for what or who to ask. But never fear, because Music Waste is here, giving you the green light to both rock and roll, bike and stroll, and otherwise vibe out. I have so many great Music Waste memories, both as an organizer and as an attendee, and I truly don't think it would be possible to pick a favorite. So I'm just going to share my first. I was at the Lido in 2017. I remember my friend was playing in their band Mirepoix alongside Daniel Terrence Robertson and Mittens, two other local bands. And I had just made it in time for my friend's set. I remember I was standing kind of close to the back of like the audience standing space where there's all the vines hanging down from the ceiling near the end of the bar, if you know what I mean. And I remember just beaming, grinning ear to ear, feeling so wholesomely surrounded and proud and held by community in a way that I hadn't felt in Vancouver before. When I did do some researching for this project, specifically about this show, it definitely was fully nighttime at that show, but in my flawed memory, it was golden hour and it had been cloudy all day, but in that moment, the sun was glowing. And I remember thinking that I really just wanted to be a part of this project. I'd never been to Music Waste before, and it just felt so good. But what is Music Waste anyway? Just to so quickly quote their website, Music Waste is an independent nonprofit music and art festival held annually on the unceded traditional territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh Nations. We are totally volunteer-run and organized. Music Waste exists to build community within the local DIY scene, amplify underrepresented artists and performers, and throw some really good parties. Music Waste first took place on a single night in 1994 as a sort of protest against the more corporate and exclusive Music West Festival. Today, the Music Waste Festival takes place over 4 days in early June. We receive hundreds of music submissions each year from almost any genre and typically present a lineup of 70 to 80 bands. With the addition of art waste and sometimes comedy waste, we also showcase visual artists and comedians in a variety of experimental formats. Okay, so what does that mean? Let's break it down. One, Music Waste is independent. Okay, easy enough. Not connected to any corporations or the government. Two, Music Waste is nonprofit. Lol, that is an understatement, but cool. So they have no money. Check. Three, Music Waste is a music and art festival. Again, easy. We know what music is, we know what art is, and we know what a festival is. Boom. Four, Music Waste is held annually on the unceded traditional territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh Nations. So it's local to Vancouver. Five, Music Waste is totally volunteer organized. Okay, that is easy enough to understand, but that sounds like a lot. How does that even work? Six, Music Waste exists to build community within the local DIY scene. In Vancouver, aka No Fun City, that's pretty important. Thanks for taking up the mantle, Music Waste. And also continue unceded Vancouver and no money. Seven, Music Waste is around to amplify underrepresented artists and performers. So there's an active focus on artists who face more barriers to performing. I guess it's not really explicitly said, but we can safely infer that those barriers are identity-based, so the festival knows where it stands politically. Eight, Music Waste is around to throw some really good parties. Easy. We love to party, and what's a good festival without some good parties? Nine, Music Waste first took place on a single night in 1994. So it's been 30 years. Wow and congrats. 10. Music Waste was against the more corporate and exclusive Music West Festival. So, reiterating the political thing and the no money thing, we love to see it. 11. Music Waste is almost any genre. Okay, now we're cooking with gas. What's the sound of Music Waste? Who's to say? That's pretty cool. 12. Music Waste is a lineup of 70 to 80 bands. So, a pretty small festival, respectively. Which makes sense because it's all volunteers, which is still mind-boggling. 13. Music Waste is art waste and sometimes comedy waste. So the festival has a visual offshoot and a comedy offshoot. That's cool. And it makes sense that those communities would have some overlap. So, bare bones, Music Waste is a festival that has music, art, and sometimes comedy. It's politically engaged, and it has no money. Honestly, that's a pretty good breakdown. Oh, and this is its 30th year. So the question on everyone's mind is, how did we even get here? We actually opened this episode with Sneakin' on the Subway by Smack. Smack was active in Vancouver in the mid-90s, and most notably and relevantly, in May 1994, when they played the very first iteration of Music Waste. I actually got to talk with Chris Mitchell, a member of Smack, who is considered the founder of Music Waste Festival.
Do you mind introducing yourself and how you got involved, I guess, at Music Waste, or I guess in your case, got started?
Yes. Chris Mitchell. At the time, I was with a jazz punky sort of band, and a whole bunch of friends and everything had applied for Music West, a festival that was like a corporate festival that was running in Vancouver. And a bunch of us didn't get in. So we said, oh, what the hell? Let's just start our own little show. And we booked a one night at this little theater. And the show was awesome. There was four bands. My band at the time was called Smack. And then there was Zolti Cracker. So the other two bands were Knockdown Ginger and then a band called Terror of Tiny Town. We had a great show, and a bunch of media showed up, and it was just one show, four bands.
And thus, Music Waste Festival was born. Just four bands saying, fuck you to the big bad Music West.
And because of the media we got after it, the next year we said, hey, well, there's more people, you know, who don't fit the mold as far as the sort of corporate festival. So we said, let's see if anybody wants to play. And we got about 80 people, 80 bands. So we said, well, we're going to have to find some more venues. So, yeah, we went around to a whole bunch of places that were like, you know, they put on shows once in a while or something like that. And we started talking to a whole bunch of people. And it became a festival, Music Waste. That was 80 bands that second year that we accepted and got spots for all around Vancouver. And the year after that was 250 bands. And then it stayed pretty much around 250 bands for the following like 3 or 4 years. I can't even remember. We shared tons of media. Like the media was really into it. You know, it was like the sort of the underdog sort of thing. And it was super fun. So it was going really well. We've shared, like we practically had half the media during the time of Music West, which was like the total corporate festival that was supposed to be the big deal in Vancouver.
Yeah, I'm kind of hearing almost a lack of curation and more just kind of like an open, almost floodgate energy.
Yeah, that's pretty much the way it was. Trying to figure out where to put everything was the biggest thing. That's what we do. Basically, that's what our job was. Embracing different communities and building each show so that that community would have its own show. It's like, you know, okay, we got a bunch of metal people who want to play. Like they're straight up metal. They're not that's such a thing anymore. So what are we going to do? Well, okay. Well, how many do we have? Like, and have they played shows together before? Like, and if they haven't, well, maybe they should. They have never even met each other and they play the same. They're playing the same stuff and they love it. You know, they would love each other. Mm-hmm. So let's set up that show and make that show happen for that community. That's what we did. And the idea was to build each scene's own strength as well so that they could continue and they could do more shows and bringing people out to live music, be it their own crew of people and stuff like that, but just to give them a place and then they could take that and continue.
And so Music Waste blossomed. But who/what was Music West? The story is almost too perfect. Itty-bitty underdog Music Waste taking on the big guy to fight corporate overlords that control the music industry. definitely in line with our breakdown of music waste as broke and politically engaged. So, I know I literally just said that we opened this episode with Smacks sneaking on the subway.
We actually opened this episode with Sneaking on the Subway by Smack.
But that was a lie. Sorry. We technically opened the show with a clip of Lori Mercer congratulating Music Waste on 30 years.
You know, Music Waste, congratulations. You lasted longer than us because you didn't have to suck on the money tit. And hallelujah to that. Hi there. My name is Lori Mercer. I've been involved with the Vancouver music scene for quite a long time in a whole bunch of different aspects. I started out as a concert promoter for punk rock bands, managed a fantastic band called No Means No, was very instrumental in the career of DOA, The Scramblers, Nervous Fellows, Pure, a bunch of other bands, and started a little event called Music West in 1991, visiting the New York Music Seminar with No Means No and the Beatniks, and realizing how impossible it was to have anybody outside the world pay attention to Vancouver bands. So I was very much an outsider, going against the corporate interests of Vancouver to try to make a make an event. And it was quite successful for 6 or 7 years before I left. That's about it.
Wait a second. Music West was founded to go against the corporate interests of Vancouver? That's hauntingly familiar, wouldn't you say?
So I started Music West because I wanted to get attention to local bands. It turned into a little bit more of a corporate shill. And I was very disappointed. And I was already kind of disillusioned. Music West had turned a bit more corporate than I wanted. I had a business partner who kind of leaned that way. So I sold my interest in Music West. That was 1997 or 8. After that, it existed in various formats, but it had, you know, I honestly feel that it had lost its juice. It was just about making money from the record companies and the manufacturers and all that stuff. But for me, it was a good time to exit because we had done what we had set out to do, which was bring the attention of the music industry to Vancouver. And, you know, we got a bunch of bands signed and had a lot of fun.
The biggest difference between Music West and Music Waste? Goals. Music Waste didn't need money and wasn't interested in the industry, while Music West was all about it. A classic case of reformation versus revolution. And in its reformative approach, Music West did face its share of barriers. They were shot down and then repackaged and sold by other industry people. They struggled to get funding. They were undercut by other promoters.
So it was a bit of a shocker to realize that the entrenched music industry locally were going to screw us over if we tried that. And so it kind of renewed our efforts. The problem was, you know, money. Money is always a problem. It was a really rocky and difficult start for us, but we kind of persisted. In 1992, we finally got the thing working. We were able to get some record company reps up. We were able to get... we flew in a band called Sloan from Halifax that, you know, got a record deal as a result of it. The manager of Sloan had been the promoter who did my No Means No and DOA shows in the Maritimes. And we were able to get it going. And once one band got record company attention in Vancouver, it was quite easy then to invite them all. Music industry and air reps are sluts who would go anywhere for free hotel, free food, free beer. So we just did that.
But there was definitely some tension between the two festivals at the time, depending on who you asked.
You know, it was competitive. Like, it depends on who you talk to. Lori Mercer is, he is, let's see, his outlook on things was very different than some of the other people in Music West. I'm sure there was a few other people who did not like us at all. It was funny because even in the back, sort of like when we were organizing things and stuff, we would get calls from Music West and he would say, oh, we got this band. We can't fit them anywhere. What do you guys think? Do you guys want to take You know, they needed a show for a grant or, you know, to be eligible for a grant or something like that. So, yeah,
People assumed Jay Scott and I, who worked the festival, we laughed out loud when we saw the name Music West. Like, why didn't we think of that? That is absolutely brilliant, right? Like, that's the kind of thinking we were. My corporate partner was taken aback. We should sue them. You know, they're stealing our trademark, blah, blah, blah. For some of them, Music West seemed like a slap in the face to all their hard work, but it wasn't. It's just, you know, when you're putting in 70-hour works to pull this impossible thing off, and then you got some snotty-nosed kids down the road saying, we'll do it for $3, you know, or whatever. It was a little bit of cognitive dissonance, but yeah, it's whatever, right? You know, we felt a little uncomfortable at first, but realized if it's the point is to bring attention, we've got all these people who are working, you know, kind of for us in bringing attention to the Vancouver music scene. And in terms of the festival, we could not book every band, right? And to suddenly see this burst of interest, like all of these garage bands had started wanting to play Music West. There was a whole bunch of signings of local bands or local indie bands that would go out and do good. The Econoline Crushes and the Skinny Puppies and there was some Oh Susanna, like broke in the folk world. There was so many things going. Spirit of the West got signed, 5440 got signed. It was an explosion of interest. And so it was kind of out of our ability to present all the bands. So the fact that these guys took initiative, like it's a party, it just made it a bigger party. But it made me realize that, like, I kind of accomplished what I had set out to do. Another reason I was able to do a little exit strategy, we were trying to bring attention, like we had done it. But there was always this phony tension. And I realized that suddenly I'd become the corporate interest. Right. And they were the freedom fighters against the man, right? And it's pretty hilarious because that had been my role for so many years, and still inside the industry, like even though I got to play with all the big boys, I was still this punk rock outsider. You know, it deserved to die, right? I mean, it didn't have anything special. It didn't have anything, you know, there was no juice left. There was nobody who cared about music. They cared about the business.
I'll be honest, I don't want to talk about Music West too much. This is a music waste documentary, after all. But this context is important. This narrative of it being so oppositional is a bit laughable to me, especially in retrospect. It just plays into this thinking where when people haven't gotten it perfect, they've gotten it wrong. Music West and Music Waste are two different projects with different goals and different approaches. Also, not to be the villain, but festival submission fees are pretty common practice, and people don't get into festivals all the time. Hundreds of projects don't get into Music Waste every year. Now, I'm not saying that the four original bands, Smack, Knockdown Ginger, Terror of Tiny Town, and Zolty Cracker, didn't have something to fight against, or that they were wrong or overreacting to start the amazing event that is Music Waste. I just think that Music West doesn't have to be a big bad. Music West's goal was different. Sure, it was an industry-focused event put on by people who wanted to make the music industry more accessible to musicians. And they did that by getting labels in the same rooms as unsigned bands, having panel series with performers, label reps, promoters, venue managers, anyone music world adjacent, and putting these people up in hotel rooms with free access to the entire festival. Music Waste is a politically engaged arts festival with no money. They do this by putting on as many shows as possible with as little resources as they have and saying thank you so much. It's just apples and oranges.
Stretches, come crashing, come crashing, come crashing to the floor. Come crashing, come crashing, come crashing to the floor. Come crashing until there's nothing left to see, hear, and go.
back to Music Waste and its journey.
I was coming to the point where I couldn't do it anymore because it was affecting making music, basically. What do I want to do? Do I want to run a festival or do I want to make music? And I was like, I really don't want to run a festival. So I hung out with, went for a talk with Darren, like basically the producer of Terminal City or editor or whatever you want to call him. And he says, if you want this to keep going, what you got to do is you got to just let it go. And so that's what I did. I just let it go. And I helped out other people to keep it going. And they did for a few years after I left. And then it basically stopped until the year that Music West said, we're not going to be able to run this year. And I said, what a fantastic time to restart Music Waste. So I went and talked to, all the usual crew, and they had a whole new crew. We just had a huge meeting with all the new kids, and then it just kept going.
So Music Waste took a bit of a break after a couple years and bounced right back when the timing was, I guess, the funniest. And it was taken over by Terminal City magazine. But who are these new kids Chris is talking about?
Do you mind just introducing yourself a little bit and then how you got involved in Music Waste?
Yeah, so that's like long and complicated. My name is Sarah Cordingly.
Now, I'm biased, but in my humble opinion, Sarah Cordingly is a legendary figure at Music Waste. You may not know it, but when you think of what Music Waste is today, you're thinking of her.
I was an intern at the Terminal City Weekly in 2003, I'm going to guess. I was sort of just like doing the calendar at the magazine at that time. And the staff at the Terminal City Weekly had been having drinks with Chris, who was one of the original founders of the first sort of incarnation of Music Waste. And I guess as the story goes, that they bought the festival off him for, I forget what it was, $50 or something. And so that year, the Terminal City took over putting it on.
Just for the sake of historical accuracy, and because I think it's kind of funny, this buying is a little contested.
I would talk to Sarah accordingly yesterday, and she was saying that Terminal City bought Music Waste from you. Is that true?
No, I don't think so.
I had no idea that it was bought off of Chris.
I mean, it was bought, air quotes bought, but yeah, definitely it was, acquired with permission, I think, is the gist of it.
Okay, anyway, back to the timeline.
At the time my band Bakelite played that year, yeah, so I sort of just started as playing in it the first year that it was revived after the 90s. And then the following year, when the Terminal City Weekly, which was, not a thing that happens anymore, but there used to be a thing called alternative weekly newspapers or alternative weekly magazines. And that was one of them in Vancouver. And there's advertising. And at the time, that was a good way to make money. And when something is or could be profitable, there's always politics. And basically, the money folks decided to fire the publisher, Darren Atwater, and that sucked. So everybody also quit. So all of those people immediately formed a new magazine called The Only, and it was Vancouver's pocket paper because it fits in your pocket. And it was like you just had to look in a newspaper to see what shows were on, basically. So you don't have to do that now, but at the time there was like a need for it. And we had a calendar, we had listings, which was important. And then it was a lot of local music content and art. And it was very like silly and irreverent and fairly rude and obnoxious and made a lot of people mad. But I like to think it was fairly charming. And so I was the music editor of the only magazine, and we took over. And then I was, yeah, one of the organizers for the next few years. And then it sort of trails off into a blur, and I don't know what happened. That first year was really something else. I guess it was 2003. It was just like when I walk around the downtown east side now, it's like there were just so many bars, and like it was sketchy, and but like they were having live music. I don't feel like that's the case anymore, but it was all just like, you know, block after block of East Hastings with shows going on all over the place, right to, you know, downtown, right to the Piccadilly pub. And yeah, it's pretty cool, actually.
And it's around this time that we also saw the cementing of art waste and later comedy waste.
It is kind of like you're just saying, like another person comes on board. It's like, you know, like when the Only was putting it on and we had this community of contributors to the magazine, and it was sort of like, oh, okay, well, we're doing this as a loose group. Like, you know, we have an art editor and they're connected with all these artists, and it just makes sense to add that in. And it's just really whatever someone who's part of the community says, like, hey, let's like make this a part of it and add this on.
This kind of activating the interests and motivations of the people involved is a huge part of how music waste continues to operate. Just to dip into the present really quickly, the current art waste coordinator, Lee Young, embodies this practice to a T.
I'm Lee. I've been doing art waste for a couple of years now. I actually didn't know there was an art waste, but I've been going to music waste as like a punk teen for like a while. I've known music waste as an entity, and then I just assumed that the art waste component was like whatever we could pull off or whatever the people running it that year could pull off. And so I didn't even experience anything before going into the role. So it almost was like a blank slate for me. I just had like, if I had an idea, then I would have a team to like help me.
Because they aren't really center stage of the whole festival, art and comedy waste are super responsive to the needs and engagement of their respective communities. For example, comedy waste hasn't run since 2018 because there just hasn't been someone on the team who's a part of that world.
My name's Aaron Reed. I do comedy and music and art and stuff down in Vancouver. And I think they were looking for someone to run the comedy section of it in, oh, I don't know, like 2017 or something like that. 2018? I don't know. So I just went to one of the meetings and yeah, and they were just like, yeah, you just want to put together some comedy stuff. So yeah, I just did that. I don't know. I think I just wanted to do it. I think it would be cool. I think they just asked me and then I was just like, sure, I'll try it.
In the mid to late 2000s, comedy had been a much bigger part of the festival until the people running it moved on.
So I don't think there had been much. It's always kind of been like a little bit peripheral, a little bit like a bonus thing. So I think, yeah, that year they wanted to kind of do more stuff. So this was kind of like a resurgence of comedy in the music waste history, I guess. A little bit for 1 year. It's not on the organizers as much either. It's like, you got to find comedy people who want to do it. And not everyone wants to produce either. Like producing is bad if you don't like it.
Do you like it?
No.
And that's such a good point. And we'll get into it more in next week's episode. But the buy-in needed to volunteer to put on an arts festival is outrageous. It's a big ask. And if the comedy scene doesn't need Music Waste Weekend, why would someone put in all that work?
The comedy, in terms of its relation to Music Waste fitting in, I don't think it really does. You know, like, I think it's kind of come and gone. Like, I think there's just not enough comedy people who are like, there's not also not a lot of crossover between. So, yeah, it kind of just comes and goes, which I think is fine.
So comedy waste doesn't really fit, and that's fine. But art waste is still going strong.
It's interesting because, like, obviously, like, music waste, you'd think the focus is music. But I think that it's just, like, I can't imagine music waste without art waste. I feel like if there's a music festival and people are being gathered in a certain place, I feel like the opportunity is there for artists to share their work, and people desire that on either side. Like, artists need platforms and artists want spaces and artists want to work with each other, and there's a severe lack of that in Vancouver. But something like Music Waste that runs for 4 days in a row, like, we'll have people visiting the same venues over and over again. It's just a perfect chance for people to see each other's art and celebrate each other's art. And like, that could be music, but like, I think it goes deeper than music. Like we said, like, all the musicians we know do other shit too. And so, like, I had a bunch of people who were in Music Waste submit to Art Waste, for example, because, you know, it's all expression. Or I was one of the tattoo artists for the Flash Day at 648 last year. And so I had the pleasure of tattooing somebody who was performing that night. So I don't know. I think these kind of memories are really important and, like, build community and build rapport amongst each other. I don't know. I think it's fun for everybody. And it's not just like I go to a band and I go home.
Previous iterations of Art Waste, from my memory, were usually a series of showings at small galleries around Vancouver. Nothing fancy. And when the last Art Waste coordinator stepped down, it very nearly met the same fate as Comedy Waste. But now that there's someone doing it because they want to do it and are doing whatever they want, it's become absolutely integral and is one of the coolest parts of the festival every year.
Over the years, I feel like I've been, like, even myself, like, I feel like I'm getting the gist of it now. Like, the first year, I had a little flash day, but I was just, like, so, like, unambitious about it. I was, like, one artist per day, per venue. And then I, like, the next year, I was, like, oh, fuck it, like, six tattoo artists at once in one space. And let's just do it, like, as much as we can, like, every day this weekend. So this year, because it's the 30th year, and I feel like I haven't even honed into my full potential of, like, what we could do for Art Waste, I think it's going to be cool and fun and big and different.
And it's this openness to change and this openness to building something new that makes Music Waste so unique. This has not always been the case with the festival in situations like this, but it is a shift in process and perspective that the festival has been working towards for a long time. And as the cogs kind of shift and morph, after Only Magazine and Sarah and crew took over, we reached a version of the festival that's a lot like what we see today. A curated number of bands performing at a bunch of smaller venues around East Vancouver, with arts events running alongside it, organized by a small group of volunteers who are involved in the local music scene and want to put the small festival on, with the verified blessing of previous organizers. Yeehaw.
You can leave it all behind. You can report it with silence.
The changing arts landscape in Vancouver is something that came up a lot when I was doing these interviews. And we'll get more into it next episode. But honestly, it's something that could be the subject of its own documentary. Vancouver is lovingly referred to as no fun city. And that comes from the city just not being able to hang. Like, at all.
We flew Craig Cox in from Detroit, one of the great DJs of his time, at the height of his peak. We rented a big building at 2nd and just off 2nd and Main Street. We tricked it out to be a rave. We got the license from the city. We set up the location. We were going to do a rave. I mean, it's a legal rave. It's not an invite-only rave. We put it in our program, and the night we did it, the cops surrounded and bust us down. Even though all the ducks were in a row, so we thought, they still shut it down. This is no fun city. The cops said, we're not having any of that. There'll be people with glow sticks doing ecstasy. We can't have it. Right? That's not Vancouver. It's like, oh, dude, that is so Vancouver.
But it's hard to talk about what Music Waste was slash is without talking about how the environment around the festival has changed so much, and for so many reasons. The biggest and most notable change that has constantly affected Music Waste is access to venues.
At the time, it felt like we were like the misfits of the city or whatever. But now I think about it and it's like, I mean, like, I wouldn't ride my bike downtown on a weekend to go to a bar. Like, what? So now I think it really would be like the misfits of the city. But like, we could take over because there were places. Yeah. I mean, there's like bars where you could hear like no wave bands perform on like, you know, Georgia Street or whatever, like right downtown. So it's a different city. Yeah, I don't know. I guess it must have happened quite gradually. I mean, and it's like still happening gradually, but yeah, it really just for some reason, the Piccadilly Pub like really like stands out to me because it's just like such a downtown like corporate area. And it was, I just saw so many good shows there, and it was like such a reasonable, sort of divey, affordable, consistent place to see live shows. You know, the Brick House was like, there were so many good live shows. And I feel a little bit like it must just be maybe like my age or I'm sure there are lots of great live shows and touring bands coming through now, but like, it felt like a real heyday, and it felt like, Channel 3 and 4 used to play like maybe like twice a weekend sometimes. Like we would play like 8 times in a month at all different bars, at like actual bars, not warehouses. And I don't even understand how that would work now because there's just not even any. But yeah, I don't know when that started happening. I really like when Miss T's burned down, that was like felt maybe like the beginning of the end to me. Like it was not a shutdown, but like it was such a like just such a cool place, and like as soon as I was gone, Vancouver felt much less cool. And yeah, and then sort of I think they started to go after that.
Again, this is a topic that could be its own series, but Sarah's not wrong. Right now in Vancouver, there's really only 3 venues where alternative music is happening regularly, and all of these spots are booked out for Music Waste this year, of course. But there aren't any bars or really any casual venues in this year's festival. One reason for this is Music Waste prioritized putting on as many all-ages shows as possible. But another reason is just because it's a lot easier. Right now, bars in Vancouver just aren't set up to host live music. And on top of gear and your own ticket sales, you also have to worry about the bar making out of money as well, plus permits and all the city's red tape. But the status of Vancouver's venues is precarious at best. And they have their own financial crises and capacity issues that have only gotten worse with time.
That was a big change that I did end up seeing throughout my time with the festival, was we did have a lot of rising costs and venue fees and such. So we definitely had some glory days of having a lot and a lot of free venues. And then that definitely moved on to paying a lot more room fees.
That's Dustin Bromley, who is a festival director at Music Waste just after Sarah.
I was involved with Music Waste for roughly 8 years, give or take. I started as a volunteer working doors, running shows, moved up to more of an organizing role, and then kind of eventually moved up to a director role for a few years, and then passed off the reins in 2014. So the venues had a lot of buy-in as well. Like, yeah, venue owners or venue managers were very, very gracious with their time and their spaces, providing them to us for free for many years. As you know, their costs rose and changes happened and venues closed and this and that.
And Music West has always had to work around this venue issue. Just think of the first few years. Music West was eating all the venues up.
There were always some sort of kind of one-off venues, maybe not every year, but definitely there were some cool opportunities that we worked with different spaces or different venues to operate. Maybe an art space that didn't usually have music. Maybe they could host some more acoustic or quieter electronic acts. We had a big barbecue in the parking lot of the Waldorf one year. I know more recently there was in the parking lot of Kingsgate Mall. That was really cool. We've always had to get a little creative. You know, it's an age-old story about Vancouver venues closing and everything. So we've always wanted to host more bands than we've been physically capable of doing, whether that's financially or actual just space on the schedule with venues.
But when you're talking about another big shift that happened internally, it was Music Waste's relationship to the industry. We heard a bit about this from Lori talking about some of the toxicity in Vancouver's music scene in the 90s. But Music Waste began as a reaction to the industry exploiting artists. And in the 2000s, that shifted to reacting to artists who operated in the industry. This is a really big shift from the festival's original focus. I mean, Nickelback played Music Waste in the 90s, for God's sake.
We would do shows like, say, there was, you know, pop songwriting piano player, like very straight pop songwriting piano player, and all their friends. You know, we would do, this is a rock band that wants to be, you know, they really want to be in Music West. So they do their, you know, I mean, the sort of more commercially oriented people. We also made places for. So it's not weirder that we were looking for. It was more people with their own scenes.
I think I'm more closely tied to it, like 2004 or whatever. I have more of an emotional connection with it, and I think that feeling or that meaning doesn't feel very relevant now, but I think at the time it was like there was just this real commercialism to independent music, and it was like just everything felt so tight and everyone was making so much money off of it. And it felt like everyone was taking themselves so seriously. And I think the intention was to not take ourselves too seriously and was just to like provide bands the opportunity to express themselves and to play without having to pay to play or without having to do a ton of work themselves and to maybe, you know, find some new audience without it being super commercial. So just to like connect with a wide variety and have it be just like fun and not serious and not trying to like sell yourself, but rather trying to connect within this like community of, you know, I don't want to say like-minded because it's pretty all over the place, but at least like people who are making art, making music for expressive purposes rather than to, you know, for status or for, you know, to be a sex symbol or to make a bunch of money. And like, I think it was just, we were just so sick of everyone taking themselves so seriously. And we wanted to sort of provide a chance for catharsis. It lines up with a lot of what was going on in Vancouver at the time, where it was like, you know, the emergency room or like the emergency room Granville Island, where just they're playing in the Emily Carr Arcade and they're dressed as like giant stuffed animals. And like, it's just like weird. It's not meant to last forever. It's not meant to be anyone's career. It's an experiment. It's like an expression. And I think it was meant to set the tone. And in a lot of ways, it did. And It wasn't about, I think people just wanted to be the most important, and it wasn't about, you know, the headliner of the festival or like this up and comer. It was about like, let's go see all of these people, as many bands as we can. Like, let's just like take over the city.
It is just an interesting, to me at least, example of a similar practice being used with a totally different principle. So while the original iteration of the festival really shied away from curation, that has become a major focus of the festival today. And it wasn't just curating the bands. It was curating a vibe. Can I be honest? It's around this time Musicway started earning a reputation for being, well, kind of mean. And a big part of how that played out was through the band bios.
Well, I guess Terminal City did the first guide with the ridiculous and not informative at all descriptions of the bands. And the only sort of took that one further. And I feel like reading them now, like I haven't read them lately, but like there's probably like a lot of not okay things. And like, it really was just like, fun to write them. And we were just all these people that like didn't take ourselves seriously and didn't want to take these bands seriously. Like we weren't trying to like make anyone famous. It was like, let's make music and make community together, but it's not, we don't want to have to like promote these bands, like just come and play, but like we're not going to be your like PR people, and we're not going to force you down people's throats. We're just gonna make it fun and make it deliberately not promoting the artists, because at the time it was just, you know, you'd read a like festival guide and it was just like everyone's like the next whatever. It was so repetitive and corporate and gross, and so we just wanted it to be fun and funny.
You know, it was 2006, 2007. It was the age of irony. It was the age of like, everyone's too cool for everything. You know, like, don't act like you like a band, like at a show. Oh, God. I feel like maybe since I knew the folks writing them, I realized that they were jokes, you know, and I could totally see from another aspect, if your band just, you're so, so excited to play this festival that you've heard about in Vancouver, and you submit and you get accepted, and then all of a sudden there's a bio that's like making some cheap shots at nothing. Maybe it's your name, you know, like I could totally see how that would be essentially. So those left the atmosphere of Music Waste after a while.
Well, it's just like, I feel like it literally goes back to my understanding of its inception of just being like, the mainstream industry, like we are gonna do our own thing, and we're not gonna be regulated by sponsors and politeness and like ties of money and rules, so we can do whatever we want, and we're gonna be a little bit shitheads about it, and we're gonna be a little saucy and a little bit mean.
And that's Eleanor Wearing, who took over the festival after Dustin.
I'm Eleanor. I was a organizer for Music Waste from 2015 to 2017, attendee for a few years after that. And I got involved with organizing Music Waste because I was working and volunteering at CITR Radio and Discorder Magazine. And some of the other staff had previously been involved at Music Waste and kind of asked if it was something that I'd be interested in doing. And as someone who had attended the festival, it was like a dream come true, because it just seemed very fun and very Vancouver, for lack of a better word. I've only lived in Vancouver as a big city, so I don't know if other cities are exactly like this, but like in cities, you know, they take themselves very seriously. And it's like, I think Music Waste is always kind of poking fun at that. And so at its best, it like kind of going after the big guy. But then at times, then it would go into kind of attacking the underdog, which is like the artists themselves. So, yeah, I think it just like kind of was edgy, you know, and you have like other things going on in the city, and like no shade to any of these things. They're very like, a lot of them are very wholesome and very like great, but you know, like Mural Fest or Car Free Day, or like, yeah, there's always something that's like a little bit cool about being like the attitude of like, I don't give a fuck. And then like people making fun of each other and like making fun of their own, like booking bands, but then like writing little blurbs about them that are kind of like making fun of them. Like, you know, it's edgy. It's like, wow, like, can we do that? You know?
Turns out people do take themselves quite seriously. And yeah, it was, I've been in a lot of trouble a lot of times. I mean, I didn't write them all. Like, I wrote like, you know, a small percentage of them. But yeah, I was like really in the doghouse. I lived in this big house with like 6 or 7 people. And I remember there was a time when like 4 or 5 of them were not speaking to me for like a week straight. So I thought they would think it was funny. Most of them were just nonsense.
The bios were fun, and they certainly like, as an example, like of a kind of thing that added to its like coolness or its edgy attitude. Like, I think it definitely got a lot of attention, which was the goal, to get people to come to the festival and to get people to come to the shows, you know, and to like get performers kind of excited about this scrappy thing. And that worked to a certain degree, you know, like especially being in our little social media age. Like, I don't even know if you can call that now, like, but even in like 2015, you know, it was a different like media landscape, and like so much shit being posted on Facebook. Like, how are you going to stand out? You're going to like write kind of like mean things about like people that you know. And that's the other thing too, is I think a lot of that was like the people running in the festival were friends with a lot of people in the band, so they could take them down a notch by like teasing them, you know. But then you run into problems where like some of them were actually mean, you know, like, which is not cool or nice or like funny.
I think we can all agree that the band bios were, to put it diplomatically, misguided. And while they arguably had their place and can be attributed to good intentions clashing with the age of irony, probably the biggest contributor to Music Waste's shithead reputation was its lineup curation and the listening parties. Let's tackle curation first.
There were years where we had more like we would have sort of more like genre shows. Like there was like a few really big folk shows when Ora Kogan was organizing with us, or like, yeah, there have been people that would sort of bring something specific. But yeah, it's always been like, I think, quite eclectic. And I think from what I can remember from the curation, or later when it was the listening parties to decide which bands, it was like a lot of like awareness of what's missing, and what having a variety, like, you know, not like having enough bands that fit together for, you know, this kind of show, but not having it just be one type. So sort of like looking for more different genres or different sort of demographics or different scenes.
2008-ish, that was kind of the heyday of noise punk or weird punk in Vancouver. There, what, you know, there's Emergency Room and such, and all these noisy punk bands, and there was kind of a cusp of, is Vancouver the next Montreal? Because, you know, Arcade Fire and them had all come out of Montreal, and people were looking for the next kind of little hotbed of a cool new genre. And there was talk of Vancouver being the noise punk central. And I think the sound of the festival for a couple of years there was a lot of noisy angular guitars. It was a lot of, you know, just very, very loud stuff, very brash. And then we moved into the age of, you know, Makeout Videotape became Mac DeMarco, and we moved a bit more into garage punk, you know, Dead Ghosts and such. And garage punk took a hold on Vancouver. Like, it had its claws in Vancouver for quite a few years, and it became a running joke in Music Waste that we would get, like, if we got 500 applications, 300 of them would be a garage punk band. And we were in those listening parties. It was tough to listen to so much reverb. That was definitely something that we got a bit more deliberate about, not featuring all of, like, we're like, okay, well, here's an electronic act, like, let's talk to them, you know, instead of another garage punk band. And if we were adding that kind of style to the festival, we are definitely looking for up and comers in that way.
I do remember, though, like, the second year I worked on the festival and we were switching the listening party, and, you know, it was a mix of like, there was like a few organizers who had been there for more time, and then, but it was mostly new people. And we like said no to some people that had just like always gotten in, you know, and it was a little like controversial, and you're like afraid to hurt people's feelings or piss them off. But it was also like, you don't need this. I mean, sorry, no one needs to play Music Waste, but, you know, it's like, you've played this every year for 10 years, you know, you want to be part of it because it's fun and you enjoy it, and that's totally valid. But also, like, what is you being in, like, who is that keeping out, you know? And you know, it took a little bit of convincing, I think, of some of the organizers who had been around longer. But, you know, no one was like, no one was unforgivably mad. Like, I think for the most part, people actually understood, and it was cool to be able to like make that choice and feel like we were kind of moving things forward. Because, yeah, it's just like you have to strike the balance, and you don't want it to just be the same like 10 bands every time. And just got people to kind of reconsider like what type of gatekeeping Music Waste had been part of, despite like trying to say that it wasn't a gatekeeper, you know, even though, yeah, it sucks to say no to people and that always feels bad. But yeah, we definitely wanted to bring in new people. And I think there was a big focus on more like all ages. So we definitely had some younger bands. I remember that being like a conscious focus. Definitely more female bands or bands with women in them was also like a big thing. And that was something that I focused on a lot of the time, because I had a radio show that was all female artists. So it was something I thought about a lot. Yeah. And that felt really cool. And not every band is like a fit for the festival. And that's okay too. Like it's not meant to be for every single person that applies, because otherwise it wouldn't be interesting.
There are a lot of things to consider when programming a music festival. It's not something that everyone has insight into or really know how to go about it. And it's hard when it's people's art that's on the line. But so people keep mentioning the listening party. What is that? Now, Music Waste has a listening committee, which is a group of maybe 50 to 60 members of Vancouver's music and art scenes that organizers invite to help screen the submissions. And they just listen and then vote on whether or not they like it. So then the organizers come together and listen to the submissions who more than 50% of the committee liked. And they do the heavy lifting of building out lineups, making sure there's a good ratio of new bands versus old, making sure underrepresented artists are featured, stuff like that. And thank God for the technology that makes that all possible. Because the way they used to do it was everyone would get together, get drunk, and listen to all of the submissions. All at once. Can you imagine listening to sometimes over 500 submissions and not losing your mind?
It was really like one of the like quote unquote perks of being an organizer, I think, was like getting to do the listening party, and you get drunk and you listen to all these bands and you judge people, you know, like, and that's fine. But like, I just remember the first year being like that I was organizing, being like, damn, like just the time that your band comes up in this like day can just depend, like totally impact what you get in or not.
We kind of ran with some aspects of that still for a few more years, of that kind of that vibe, I guess. For example, we'd have a couple guests who weren't organizers come to the listening party every year. And the listening party was it was a crap show. It was just, it was, you know, 12 or 13 hours or 14 hours of everyone having beers and listening to, who knows, 500 different artists, right? And trying to make some sort of guess, educated guess on hearing small snippets of their songs, if we want them to play the festival or not.
So it's a ridiculous system, and it made for some, retrospectively, ridiculous decisions.
It might be like the first or second year of Garage Waste, as we were calling it for a while, where there was just you know, waves of these reverbed guitars. And then this group, this I think it was a two-person rap group called Hot Sex and High Finance came on. And it was like probably 8 hours into the listening party, and every single one of the organizers was up out of their chair and just like just fucking having a time to like... Later, we discovered were problematic lyrics and such. But at the time, we're like, yes, this is perfect. They're in. Put them in. You know, it was just instantly. So like I said, there are groups that shouldn't have got into the festival that did. There's groups that should have but didn't. But just in that situation of being placed between all of these bands that sound very similar because of the trend at the time, they stood out. They're kind of seen as a diamond in the rough at the time because of that circumstance.
But it all really came to a head in 2012 when Music Waste invited Vice to sit in on the listening party and see how the cookie crumbles.
There were some elitist attitudes. There were some, I said this every year, there are artists that should have played Music Waste that didn't get in. There are artists that shouldn't play Music Waste that did get in. Wait, did I say that right? Yeah. Like there, it goes both ways. It's just the listening party. We did what we could, really. But one thing that I came to not like after a couple of years, I was totally part of this for a few years, but like we would just rip into bands. If we didn't like them, we would, or acts, like we would really dig into them. But we also saw it as just, we had a lot. We were having a lot of fun. It wasn't a great environment. Anywho, so after a couple of years, Mish Wei came and took part in it doing an article for Vice, kind of. And so that article came out. I just looked for it this morning. It's still up. So I remember when that article came out, I was so embarrassed. I read it and I'm like, oh, I am such a jerk. Like, or like, this stinks. It was definitely like the next year that we really made an effort and made a more focus on being positive and supportive. So yeah, it took kind of reading it from this outside perspective, or just seeing, I was so excited about that article too. I'm like, oh, like Vice, like we're gonna have like a cool feature in like a bigger magazine and like get the word out outside of Vancouver, because it had been a couple of years at that point since we'd had some good press outside of Vancouver. So I just really wanted to kind of connect with the broader Canadian indie festival circuit as a whole. But yeah, when that article came out, it was just I didn't want to advertise it really at all. Yeah, it was sobering for sure.
I wouldn't say it's perfect now, but the impact of that Vice article jolted Music Waste, and by extension, Vancouver's music scene, to reevaluate, why were we acting like this? Tricky thing. When you're organizing it, because you're a volunteer, you've willingly placed yourself in a position of relative power and responsibility. And it's not just responsibility to the other organizers or to the mechanics of putting on a music festival. It's a responsibility to the music and arts community in Vancouver. But then also, who are you? More often than not, you're just a guy standing in front of a festival, praying that it gets its shit together. And to give so much effort to this project that's outside of you, you have to be so invested. And it becomes, in a lot of ways, a reflection of you.
I'm too inside of it. Like, it was like, I felt like it was like my identity. And there were so many big things where like 75% of my friends were angry at me for a month because of the write-ups and the thing. And like, just like, everyone was always mad about like, but why don't bands get in for free? Like, there was just always complaints. And I'm like, I'm just trying to do a thing. Like, I'm not like a professional person. I'm not getting paid for this. I just like want to see lots of bands play and ride my bike around, and like everyone's just like mad all the time.
It's kind of a lose-lose of where you draw the line between yourself and the festival, especially when it comes to conversations around politics, representation, meanness, because it is something that you feel so close to and are so proud of. So critiques of the festival can begin to feel like attacks on yourself. It can be a lot.
It's fair. And everyone that works at Music Waste are volunteers. Like, it's we're a bunch of goofs that are just trying to make this festival happen. But like, it's no excuse. I think it wasn't friendly to the community that had given us a lot. And again, I feel like it was an artifact of that irony time where like that was a bit more accepted, but you know, like I think we're a bit slow to adjust our habits.
Maybe it's just like the scrappiness that adds to that coolness. I don't know. A lot of like unintentionalness, which I think has actually become less cool now. Like I think things being more intentional and more not necessarily planned, but like doing things and like not trying to pretend like you don't care about them is more cool than it used to be. And I think I was coming on when that was changing, like when it was starting to become more socially acceptable to be like, no, this matters to me and I care about it and I'm gonna like tell you why I care about it and I think it's beautiful and awesome and great. Like I think even like 5 or 6 years before that, like earnestness wasn't as cool. I don't know. I've always been a very honest person, so I was definitely like faking it a bit to like fit into that, and it felt kind of cool. But then I very quickly was like, oh, like this does not feel like actually authentic to me or like what I think people actually want, you know. So I think if Music Waste had continued to like do the one day listening party and like only bring in people that already knew people, it would have stopped. Like it would have just like, you know, there would have been like call outs or call ins or however you want to describe that. There already was that happening, which is I think always a good thing. And like there just would have been it just would have kind of stagnated and it would have been more of the same bands playing all the time. And I'm not sure that it would have like continued to last. So it's kind of like adapt or die.
But luckily, Music Waste did adapt. It's specialty. Thank you so much for tuning in to Time Not Wasted, a radio documentary looking back at 30 years of Music Waste Festival, airing on CITR 101.9 FM and CITR.ca, broadcasting from the unceded, ancestral, traditional, and shared territories of the Musqueam, the Squamish, and the Tsleil-Waututh Nations in the city colonially known as Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. This was part one. Hallelujah to that. In this episode, we went through the basic history of Music Waste Festival and talked a bit about maybe the more nuanced history of its role in Vancouver's arts scene. Next week's episode airs on Wednesday, June 5th at 3 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM and CITR.ca, and we'll be talking about where the festival's at now, the changes it's made in the past few years, and how those changes came to be. I want to give a huge thank you to all the amazing volunteers, acquaintances, friends, and angels I had the privilege of speaking with for this documentary. Dustin Bromley, Natalie Corbo, Sarah Cordingley, Naomi Endale, Duncan McHugh, Lori Mercer, Chris Mitchell, Aaron Charles Reed, Eleanor Waring, and Lee Young. Thank you for sharing your insight with me, and I feel so lucky to consolidate these stories. Thanks to Kiara Reed for your generous editorial guidance. And last, but certainly not least, thank you to Music Waste Festival. Music Waste runs June 6th to June 9th. Go to musicwaste.ca to see the festival schedule, the full lineup, and get more information. This episode was written and produced by me, Dora Duber. The music used was Smack, Sneaking on the Subway, The Bakelites, Fall, Aaron Charles Reed, Evil in My Head, Make Out Videotape, I Guess the Lord is in New York, Lucky, We'll Find the Time Somewhere, and Dumb, Mint. All music featured in this episode can be found in CITR's music library.